Tzaddik Aleph. Sure, we were holding by Omar Marzutra. And this was two lines below, a third of the way long. Omar Marzutra, Mishmeder of Papa, Hilchot Achat, Bechaya Vechad, Nuto, Yeshlem Tuvat Mindichrin. Furthermore, Tuvana Sit Motal Chavrata. So the two issues that we discussed this morning, two very fundamental issues. The first of which, is there in fact a din of Ktuvat Pnin Dichrin where the two groups are not going to inherit in the same way, and that only the set of children from one mother are going to be getting Ktuvat Pnin Dichrin, and the which will be taken out of the estate, whereas the Yerusha of the estate, whereas the other group is going to be inheriting directly the Chov, which is a typical debt against the estate, is not a Yerusha of the estate, and they do not have the right to take the Yerusha. So we might have thought that they will come le'intsuye, and claim that it's unfair. Chazal won't make a takana like that. That's going to end up having families broken up over Yerusha. And because of that, we might have thought that there's no din of b'nei dichrin in that case. The halacha, however, is, reports Marzutra in the name of Rav Papa, that there is a din of ktuvah b'nei dichrin, because ultimately both are going to be getting a ktuvah. The technicality that one is against the estate as a Yerusha, and the other is against the estate as a debt, not so bad. Then there was the other issue. The other issue was, normally, remember, when we come to collect a ktuvah b'nei dichrin, it can only be collected if it doesn't violate the halacha of Yerusha d'oraita, which means that if the two ktuvot together equal the amount of the estate and don't leave any additional value over to be split equally between all of the heirs, there cannot be a ktuvah b'nei dichrin, and the whole clause of the ktuvah does not apply in those circumstances. So the question is, in this particular case, where one of the ktuvot is not a ktuvah b'nei dichrin, one of the ktuvot is a ktuvah that is actually being paid up as a debt. We entertained the notion this morning that because the debt must be paid after there is a Yerusha, so technically speaking, what really happened was the heirs together inherited the property before we took off the ktuvah b'nei dichrin. They then together paid up a debt that was due. It happened to have been due to a group of the Yorshim who had a particular mother, but that's irrelevant. So that means we have a significant Yerusha that was already split evenly, and that money was used to pay up the Yitomim that were collecting the Ketuvah. In that case, we thought that perhaps the din would be that the Ketuvah b'nei dichrin would not be viewed as violating the Yerusha d'oraita, because the Yerusha d'oraita was already actualized and used to pay back the group of the second mother who had died after the father had died. Remember? Are we okay with this? Okay, everybody has to give me a little bit of blank there. I just want to make sure this is all okay. The good doc, after a whole day of taking out appendices, I think, is able to pull this out of this argument. So the halacha about that is also that indeed that's true. A ktuvah is naaseit motar l'chaverta. So that when an estate pays up the debt that's due to a ktuvah, that's considered to be a Yerusha. We no longer have to worry whether there is any longer a motar dinar for the first group to be able to collect ktuvat b'nin dichrin. Now, on the surface, this appears a little bit silly. Because the only applicability of ktuvah naaseit motar l'chaverta is obvious in a case where there is a ktuvah that is not b'nin dichrin, and there also is a ktuvah that is b'nin dichrin. So if you have to tell me the halacha already, the ketuvah naaseit motar l'chaverta, what's the point of the first statement that you made? There is no case where we'd have to think about ketuvah motar l'chaverta, unless it's talking about that achat b'chaya v'achat b'moto. So once you told me the second part, I already know the first part, by definition. Tell me what else you'd be referring to. Where ketuvah naaseit motar l'chaverta? So why does he need to talk so much? Look, if the only part of the statement was the first part, and indeed it would not be true that ketuvah naaseit motar l'chaverta, I understand that he needed to say that. And he hadn't said, so then I would have said, okay, that's the halacha, but maybe that halacha only obtains if there is a motar dinar. Iika motar dinarin ilolo. But in fact, he says more than that. So since he says more than that, then all you need to say is the last piece. Just say those words. I'm not an idiot. I know what that means by definition is as follows. In a case where one of the wives died in the lifetime of the husband, and therefore the children were now going to collect b'din dichrin when the husband does die. And one of the wives died after the death of the husband, and therefore her children were not going to get the nida for it. And her debt, her ketuvah was due as a debt. And then there would not need to be motar dinar, and we would allow the first one to collect ketuvah and nida chrin anyway, without a motar dinar. Is it really necessary to tell me, oh, by the way, if only one of them has a nida chrin and one of them has a ketuvah, it's also okay? Obviously it's okay, otherwise why are we discussing this ridiculous case? And why did he need to say this? Ani yadana, I'm not so stupid. I can figure out myself that the only possible case is Mishum HaKad B'Chayav HaKad B'Mato Yeshem K'tuvah B'Din Dichrin. Says the Gemara, well, you're not as smart as you think, because I can come up with a brilliant case where there is K'tuvah B'Din Dichrin against the collection of a K'tuvah and we still have to worry about whether K'tuvah Naseit Notar L'Chavratah. Watch. Simple case. You got to think things out properly. Yashminach, let's say he would only have said the second statement. So I would have said, gee, that's interesting. He never said that there's ketuvah and nidichrin when one is b'chayev and one is b'motah, right? So where would this obtain if not in that case? Ah, I got it. The case would be like this. Havamina. It's a case where a guy marries three wives. Two of those wives indeed died b'chayev. So we now have two sets of yorshim that are going to collect ketuvah and nidichrin. Obviously, these two sets of yorshim are worried about whether there's motar dinar. Ah. But there's a third ketuvah as well. The third ketuvah, so you say, well, so that's the same thing, what's the difference? That's silly, what's the difference? Well, it's two b'chayev or one. Oh, no. The third ketuvah does not have any male children. It has a female. So there's no benin dichrin, which means any male children from you. So now that there's a female whose mother died after the death of the husband, later than the other two wives, she is coming now to collect her mother's ketuvah. She is the sole heir now of her mother. Okay. Is she going to complain, gee, this is terrible. How come those guys have a right to ketuvah benin dichrin? Because you're a girl and you're not taking part in this Yerusha, that we have to explain the facts of life. So obviously she can't very well be coming to take them to court about the fact that she's a female and they're male. So therefore, we now don't need to worry about the question of whether benin dichrin would apply in a case where they're not all benin dichrin. Okay. But we do have to worry about, but wait, there are still two women that died that left benin dichrin. Those two women, we added up their ketuvot, and guess what? It added up to the entire value of the estate after we would take off the ketuvah of the female who now tries to collect her mother's ketuvah. Comes along Rav Papa to tell us the payment of the female's ketuvah is, in fact, motar dinar. Because the Yerusha took place, we paid up the debt to the third wife's female child, her sole remaining heir, and now we've got two ketuvot benin dichrin, who, despite the fact that after collection will leave not a penny for mutual sharing between the two groups, that's irrelevant, because they've already paid, they've already inherited by paying up the debt to the third ketuvah. There you go. Perfect. Now, if you don't tell me the first statement, I have absolutely no way of coming to my own conclusions about that based on the limited information that you gave me. So Papa's got to say it. I love it. Come on, tell me you're not. Do you get the case? It's so simple. All we need to have is a case where we need to worry about motar dinar. Okay, so then there needs to be a Yerusha Diraita between two groups of families that come from two women. Fine, let those two women both be ketuvah benin dichrin. So now you're saying, but so then where's the third ketuvah to pay up? The third ketuvah is not benin dichrin. It's a female child that's now collecting her mother's ketuvah. The mother died after the father died. So what's your problem? Now you got to decide whether ketuvah is naseit motar. It is. You have a problem with that? No. Okay, now I want to know, what about a case where there were two wives, or three wives, all of them had male children, two of them died b'chayav, one of them dies achar mato. What's it doing over there? I don't know. Maybe there's no ketuvah benin dichrin when it's not fair. But some of them are collecting as a direct chov and some are collecting as a yerusha against the estate. Do I know? Comes on Rav Papa Terek. I better tell you that. The din is that over there is also ketuvah benin dichrin. Thank you very much. So you're telling me two completely different halakhos with nothing to do with each other. See what happens when you don't think it through? So let's just take a look inside over here. You got the case. So I would have said, that. No, it's not that way at all. Hava mina. The case would be kagon shenasa shalosh nashim, umeitu shtayim b'chayav, ve'achat b'moto, and the one that died after the death of her husband had a single female child. And let it in the kevahi, And therefore, she's not a bat Yerusha, so she can't very well complain about the fact that all those meanies are collecting ktuvah b'din dekrin against my property. The property has nothing to do with her. So she can't say anything about it. But maybe indeed, achat b'chayave, achat b'moto. And the third case would be the la'achar mita. The second case is that the la'achar mita is a zohar and does have rights to the Yerusha. Oh, I don't know then. That would be a problem. Maybe we should be chayash li'intsuye, that ati li'intsuye. Kamash ron rav papa. No problem. And we do that as well. Excellent. Saba Josh, you ready for Zakai Lekabishna? Where's Rabbi Yisrael? When we need him. Yeah, he found out that I was coming. It's amazing. Jonathan finds out, zips off to Cape Town. Yisrael finds out, zips out to Yerushalayim. Okay, Zakai Lekabishna. Mi shahayana sushtei nashim. Umet. So, all right. Here is the Mishnah we've been taking for granted all along about the din, that there needs to be a motar dinah. So a guy is married to two women. They both die, and then he dies. Now the yetomim are mevakshim ktuvat imam as a case of ktuvat b'din dekrin, right? But ein sham ela shtei ktuvot. But all that the estate is worth is the value of both of those ktuvot, and not a penny more. In that case, chokin b'shaveh. In that case, they're going to have to split evenly, because the ktuvah, the Yerusha, the Oraita, takes precedence over ktuvah b'din dekrin. Hayasha motar dinner. However, if there is in fact a dinner that can now still be split, so then ve'ilu notlin ktuvat iman, and the dinner now is split between them evenly. Now suppose the yitomim, who are in line for a ktuvat b'din dekrin that is worth more than the other groups, ktuvat b'din dekrin, I'll tell you, it's worth the smile, even if you're late. All I can see coming is the teeth, but that's okay. So, in that case, the dinner is sufficient to be the Yerusha D'Oraita, and they have Ktuvat Imam. Well, suppose the group that stands to get more money, because their mother's Ktuvah was worth more, or maybe because there's fewer of them in the family, so they're going to end up getting more because they're splitting the Ktuvah in fewer ways, right? So they are very distraught because they see that the property is really worth only precisely the value of the two ktuvas. So they say, what do you mean it's worth precisely? We're talking about 300,000 dinar. You're telling me it's precisely the value. How about if we just speak to the accountant? Because we're certainly willing to view this property as being worth 301,000 dinar, okay? What do you think about that? We're very broad-minded. 301,000 dinar. A little bit of fudge factor in a spreadsheet, for God's sake. Okay, now give us our ksuna. Right, so, is it really? Anach ma'alim anichse avinu, you fed dinner, it's fine, it's worth 301. Kideshi yutluk tuvat iman. Ein shomim lehen. Ela shamina tenachasim bebeit din. Rashi understands this to mean not literally, but rather there must not be a fudge factor in, you cannot have an assessment of the property that is being made to try to get a particular result, which every accountant knows is the real way you do accountancy, right? But over here, it's got to be a blind assessment. Nobody knows what this is all about. That's all that it means. It doesn't literally have to be in Beis Din because they're willing to go the extra mile. Only Beis Din can enforce it. It means what an assessment means is an assessment that is not prejudiced. It's not trying to come out with a particular result. Okay. So in Shomim Lam, whatever the assessment is, that's what the assessment is. If there is property that is going to be coming in but hasn't yet come in. So let's say now the father died, the grandfather's alive. The grandfather's going to die one of these days, leaving the property to the dead father, which then is going to go immediately to his living children. Right? That's the way it works. The father is Yorish Bekever, Yerusha goes to the Kever, so to speak, and then comes to whatever heirs are alive. So the kids say, look, yes, it's true that today there's not really much value in this estate. It just covers the ktuvah of our respective mothers. But it's not as if we're not going to be inheriting our father one of these days. There's still a Yerusha D'Oraita. It just hasn't arrived yet. So you're not being mavato the Yerusha D'Oraita. The din over there is that ra'ui is not kimuchzak. We don't look at something that's going to be coming in as if it has already come in. Now, you'll notice the similarity of this to the Gemara we had earlier today in our attempt to explain Rabbi Shimon about if the estate had Mishabde, right? And Mishapte sounds like exactly this case, that there was money that was due in that there was a lien against. Because of that, there is in fact a Rashi that doesn't appear here, but there's an early version of Rashi on this Pesachla. It's called the Mahadura Kama. The Mahadura Kama of Rashi is often quoted by the Shita. So Rashi speaks out that actually what Mishapte means over there is not that money is due to the estate, but that the estate owes money. And what it's saying is that if the estate owes money, there's a lien against a particular property, that doesn't count. It's not part of the evaluation of the estate. However, others argue, and explain it the way we explained it this morning, and they say it has nothing to do with this. Because Meshavde is not simply money that's going to be coming in when the grandfather dies one day. Meshavde means that there is an existing lien on a piece of property, it's a chov, and it's as if it's already collected. So that's not the same as ro'ui. It's much more than ro'ui. It simply means you got to go to the bank with this piece of paper in order to get it done, that's all. But that's not the same thing as waiting for somebody to die and inherit money, obviously. So it could well be that it does mean, and therefore Rashi took out this pshat. He no longer says that that's the point of Mishav. He actually leaves it blank. So it could be in either direction. Okay, so we can have it either way. I'm just bringing this up to clarify the issue from earlier. So now it becomes, now that we see the other point of view, it's easier to understand. So Rabbi Shimon Omer, Rabbi Shimon takes it a step further. We've already seen Rabbi Shimon. And he says, you know, it's more than that. I feel yesham nechasim she'en le'machrayut enam klo. Even if you are going to be splitting up this estate, the perfectly valid Yerusha, you're right, but it's a bank account, and it's not a piece of real estate, then it doesn't count as the Motar Dinar at all. The Motar Dinar has to be real estate. So, because what's interesting, that we have a little bit of a paradox. We give you, and it's important to make this distinction, as it often occurs in the Gemara, we are giving you a Tnai HaKetuvah. The Tanayak Tuvah is that male children will inherit in the estate, right? So you would think, okay, so inheritance is taken from the estate. I mean, it's not real estate. Inheritance is inheritance. If there's a bank account, that's also inheritance. But remember that the inheritance has only been given as a Tanayak Tuvah. And the Tanayak Tuvah are only collectible out of real estate. So even though you're saying what I will be collecting out of real estate is I'm viewing as an inheritance, that doesn't change the fact that there's no way to collect a Tanai HaKetuvah from anything but real estate. So it's sort of a mixed bag. There's the mechanism, which means it's a Tanai HaKetuvah. It's collected like the Ketuvah. That's the mechanism of collection. Then there's the definition of what that collection is considered. Collection is considered to be inheritance. Says Rabbi Shimon, okay, but the bottom line is, it's really only going to be taken out of property. So we need to examine the property issue over here. And if there's not a motar dinar in the property, and the chachom, of course, are made of it, it's only collected from property. But they're saying, so what? The point is, your problem is to be mevatel of the Yerusha D'Oraita. You're not being mevatel of the Yerusha D'Oraita, which is certainly not only taken from real estate property, it's taken from anything. So who cares as far as the motar dinar is concerned? Why look at the ketuvah b'din dichrin? Why not look at the Yerusha D'Oraita to define where motar dinar is? Turn around one.
Rob, it definitely sounds like the Mishnah is leaving it up to interpretation of, as we said earlier, to make it 301,000, one or 300,000. It definitely sounds like there's a lot of interpretation leading up to a lot of, could be messing around to change the whole.
Right, that's right. That's right, exactly.
It really is leaving a lot of shady area.
Right, yeah, well, that's why some learned that it's actually talking about over here that we got a different assessment. They're not just saying we will accept it. They bring in an assessment.
Yeah.
They said, look, I mean, here we went to
but
a guy,
and he came,
exactly, yeah, you get what you want, basically. That's the whole problem. Tanarabon. So the brightness is like this. The Zohar Levzot, the Zohar Chameshmeh. Suppose one of them has a ketuvah for 1,000. One of them has a ketuvah for 500. Im yesha motar dinar, elo notlim ketuvat iman, ve elo notlim ketuvat iman. So here we have a ketuvah, an indichrin, uneven amounts, 1,000 or 500. So if there's motar dinars and they will not drink tuvat iman, they will not drink tuvat iman, vimlav yachloku b'shaveh. Now on the surface, this seems to be simply a restatement of the Mishnah, right?
Yeah.
But it's not. Why is it not? Because there's two possible advantages in ketuvah b'nin dichrin. One is an uneven amount of money. The other is an uneven amount of descendants. Now, if I hadn't seen this brayta, I might have thought, ketuvah b'nin dichrin certainly is not going to give an unfair advantage against the estate of 1,000 against 500. What it does is it gives you equal rights in the estate, except that because your mother had fewer children, you're all going to end up with more money. But the estate's not going to be damaged by the fact that one woman had more money. Comes on the bride and says, no. 1,500, that's also going to be collected as ketuvah b'nin dichrin, irregardless of the number of children. That's not the point. so that both issues of Ketulat and Dichrin are going to be applicable. Even when the estate, you would think one of them would say, that's ridiculous. You're eating up the whole estate. Look, you're getting your mother's ketubah, you know. What do you want? She wasn't worth a thousand. They'll never fight about that. Now, says the Gemara, Pshita, it's obvious that Merubin v'nitma'atu, farzachu b'em yorshin. Suppose the property was worth a certain amount of money at the time at which the father died. And then there was a drop in the real estate market. And now it's no longer worth the motar dinar over and beyond the value of the two ketuvot. So it's obvious that since the Yerusha, I mean, what's our concern? Our concern is we don't want ketuvah b'din dichrin overriding the deoraita, right? Okay. In this case, obviously, it's not going to override the deoraita. Because the deoraita is concerned with, at that moment of the Yerusha. That moment of the Yerusha, it's kosher Yerusha, we're going to split the Yerusha. Afterwards, it turns out there wasn't money. I mean, that's just circumstances. You know, there was a fire. I mean, what does that have to do with being Mavatal or the Yerusha Diorite? So that's for sure, we would say.
Sorry, what defines the moment of Yerusha? The moment death, the father dies.
Moment of death.
Not the moment they split it.
That's right. That's when the Yerusha takes place. The splitting is just the formal taking the money and giving it separately to the groups that are going to be getting it. So in that case, for sure, it was kosher. With the ketuvah, we had the motar dinner, and that's okay, because kfar zochu b'em yorshim, the moment of death, we already split everything up. There's one dinner here to split evenly, there's 500 to be given to this group, there's 1,000 to be given to this group, boom, that's it. Now Bezin just has to formalize the giving it over and issuing the checks. But what happens in between, that's just viewed as coincidence, circumstance, and circumstances happen, as far as Gump would say. But in a case where the other way around, what happens? How about if they were the other way around, mu'at, they weren't worth much money at the time of the Yerusha, and then by the time Bezin gets around to the Chalukah, property values go up, and now there's plenty of money to split evenly. So, I mean, you would say, well, I mean, you just said it goes according to the moment of death, and the moment of death is not going to be Yerusha, so, I mean, why are we discussing this? No, come on. I mean, we understand that there was a purpose to Ketuvah Nindichrin. What was the purpose? The purpose was that we want to encourage parents to invest in their children's future. So this way, if they're putting in money into a marriage in which they never know who's going to end up walking off with this money, the guy's going to go and he's going to marry another woman, and then her children are going to, he's going to have 10 children for that woman and maybe only one children from our daughter. We're not going to invest in that. So in order to reassure him and make him feel any money he puts into a marriage of a daughter is going to stay with his descendants. So we created the Ketuvah Nindichrin. We reluctantly had to be mevater on Ketuvah Nindichrin in order not to be mevater the Yerusha Diorayta, right? Fine. So you're telling me that what? Over here I'm mevater the Ketuvah Diorayta? Let me just ask you something. Bottom line is, a month from now, a month from the death, are they going to walk into a court and they're going to split an estate that's worth a lot more than the Ketuvot? Yes. So, I mean, why should we give up on the Ketuvah Nindichrin? Because we arbitrarily decided, well, since it wasn't at the moment of death, so therefore we have to ignore the whole thing. Maybe what we should say is that since our interest is in preserving the takkan of Ketuvah Nindichrin, so whether the collection takes place at the moment of death, we'll take that as an excuse for Ketuvah Nindichrin, even if it never happens, because the value went down. But the other way is also true. If the property values increase, oh, great, there's a Ketuvah Diorayta, a Yerusha Diorayta, great, now we can reinstitute, in this case, a Ketuvah Nindichrin. Why not look at the bottom line? The bottom line is they're going to have what to split. Great. So we want to maintain Ketuvah Nindichrin wherever possible. What's the din? Do we formalize this and say it's definitely going to be taken at the time of death, and that's it? Or do we keep it open and say, look, as long as somehow or other works out that either by looking at it that way or looking at it that way, there will be Ketuvah Diorayta, we'll have our excuse to institute Ketuvah Nindichrin. That's the question. But Toshma, let's learn it from the following case. The case was of a certain family, the Nifse de Bei Bar Tzartzur. There was a family that was this fellow Bar Tzartzur. He had a number of wives, different amounts of money, would do for various ketuvot. He dies, and he leaves Nechasim Muatim, so that everybody thought, okay, there was not going to be a ketuvah Nindichrin. And now, property values went up. All of a sudden, the Nechasim of Bar Tzartzur are worth enough to split, besides paying off the ketuvot. So obviously, the people who had the larger ketuvah sued. He said, okay, well, now there's enough money for you to split the single dollar that's going to be left. We want our extra money. Right? Okay. So they come to in front of Rav Amram, out to the Kamer of Amram. Well, Marlus Rav Amram said, look, basically I hold that really it ought to obtain So he says to the children of the Ketuvah Ketana that we're going to lose out if this happens, he says, if I were you, I would try to make a deal. Try to reach some kind of compromise, because I'm telling you, things look bad. So you try to make a compromise with the other group and tell them maybe they can take half of the Ketuvah in the Ukraine and you won't sue them, and then everybody will be happy. Because if you're going to sue, it doesn't look good. I'm telling you right now that I am not to say that actually the Ketuvah Gedola will be able to collect and you'll be left with splitting the buck. No. So, lo hashkechu, they didn't pay any attention to him. Amalu, he said to him, gentlemen, if you are not going to take action on this and reach a compromise with them, I'm warning you right now. I am going to use a taser on you. No blood, but we're going to tase you. Meaning, there's ways that I have. Maybe a little harem or something. We'll make your life miserable. There won't be any blood, but believe me, it's worth your while. So Shadrina, the commune of Reb Nachman, in the end he sent it to Reb Nachman. Now we know Reb Nachman was the Dayan par excellence. He had the connections with the Beit HaNasi, and he was able to enforce any rulings, whatever he was. These guys were making trouble for Reb Amram. He says, what do I need these guys on my head? Send them to Reb Nachman. He'll take good care of them. So he sends them to Reb Nachman. Reb Nachman says to them, look, Kishem Shemerubim v'nitmatu, in exactly the same way, that if at the time of death there were Merubim and they were mitmayet, Zochuba and Yorshim, the din over there was that the Yorshim were Zocha at that moment. The same thing is true in the other direction. Muatim v'nitrabu, Zochuba and Yorshim. Now Rashi learns, this is a very vague statement, Rashi learns what that means. Zochuba and Yorshim means the Yorshe haktuva haktana, because he says Kishim, meaning, let's use the same logic. Did we not follow the rule that it goes according to death? Goes according to death? Then the din is that there's no Yerusha D'Oraita in this case that money was left for. And therefore, the big boys don't have the right to take their ketuvah. The little boys of the ketuvah ketana, they get the property split with everybody. In which case, he was paskening against Rav Amram, who had sent them to him. Right? And it was a good thing they hadn't compromised. Because now they're going to get the whole thing to split. That's how Rashi learns. However, Tosis, the fact is, and he brings the Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbeinu Chananel agrees with this approach also. However, it could also be read as, in the same way as we use an excuse, which is that we'll take the time of death as an opportunity to institute Benin Dichu, and we will allow you, therefore, to collect as the Bnei Ketuvah Gdola, so too, in this case, the Bnei Ketuvah Gdola will collect because it was Nitrabu, in which case he was siding with Rav Amram and he was basking against him. Right? Okay, so we have a machlokas rishonim about this. Now, similar to the case that we had in the Mishnah, in which we want to introduce a fudge factor in the estimated value of the nechasim in order to allow us to get what we want out of it, we have something that has some level of resemblance. There was a case where Ahu gavad avimaskebe alfa zuzi. There was a guy against whom there was 1,000 zuz that he owed, and all that he had been treyah patna. He owned 2 beautiful homes, and he had sold one for 500 zuz. He sold the other for 500 zuz. He now has no money left, and he now has no property. The Baal Chov comes along, sees that he's got nowhere to collect, actualizes his lien against one of these properties, which is worth 500, takes it in lieu of 500. So now he's tarfel achadim inayu, and now he's approaching the other owner with a court document of seizure that says he can take this over. So he wants to collect the other 500. This guy sees him coming, and obviously he's spoken it over with his lawyer. So he's got an interesting approach. The other guy takes 1,000 zuz in cash, and he walks over to him and he says, oh, look, I'm going to make you a deal you can't refuse, okay? If you're ready to accept that the value of this house is actually 1,000 zuz, and you're going to let me give it to you, then that's great. Okay? So you can take it. Now, of course, if it isn't worth 1,000 to you, I'm going to actually up its value. I'm giving you 1,000 in cash. I want to take this back. You say it's not worth 1,000. Okay. I'm going to pay you 1,000. Sir, you just collected 1,000 for the debt. You have no more claims. Give me back that house. And don't you dare touch my house. And now I am the proud owner of everything that you were going to get. And you can't take away my home. So what this guy has essentially done was artificially raise the value by being willing to pay that much for it. I said, look, I'll give you $1,000 for it, in which case you already collected your $1,000. So leave me alone. What are you going to say? Well, it's not really worth that much. Okay, then I'm paying off the debt to give it back to you. What's the debt? So the Elo, Shokel Alfizuz, if he's stalik, if not, take the $1,000 and just get out of here. So Zusava Rami Bar Chamala Meimar, and the question over here is, can I, in fact, force this person to relinquish the rights to his lien, which, after all, was only a lien in lieu of payment, by my seeing to it that he gets his money back? Or does a lien actually give you rights of collection? You don't like it? That's tough. My business is with the borrower. You're not the borrower. What do you mean you want to pay me money? Who are you to pay me money? I like this house. You want to pay me for the house? You're claiming the house is worth nothing. It's not. I have an assessment. Don't artificially raise the value of the house. So that's the question. How do we look at this? Do we look at this? Look, I had a right to collect. The guy didn't have... As a matter of fact, I suspected that that idiot was going to end up bankrupt and I was going to collect the houses. That's why I made the loan, like any decent bank. Now somebody wants to come along and actually pay off the mortgage? What, is he messing up our whole plan and what? That's So that's the question. So Rami Bar Chama thought, you know what? Isn't that the case of the Mishnah? Isn't that the case of the Mishnah? The Mishnah has a case in which one of the groups of the Yatomim wants to artificially inflate the value of the property in order to allow themselves the Yerusha of Ketuvah Pnim Dikrin. And the Mishnah says, no, we don't allow artificial inflation of property values. So don't say to us, well, we're willing to pay that kind of money for it. It's irrelevant what you're willing to pay. We go to an assessment, and we have it done without any kind of prejudice. So that's the same thing over here. Hainu matintin. Im yom amru ayatomim. Reyanu malim al nichse avinu yofa dinner. It says we don't listen to them. Says Rava to Rami Bar Chama, what are you talking about? This is not similar to the Mishnah at all. In the case of the Mishnah, it's one group who's going to artificially raise the value against the other group. So they're going to cause a straight-out loss of money to the group of the Yatomim who have the smaller ketuvah. So of course we're not going to listen to them to artificially raise the value. But in this case, who's being hurt? Tell me. Is the guy getting back his money? He was supposed to collect $1,000. Did he collect $1,000? Do I care why he collected $1,000? Artificial, not artificial. What's the difference? The guy is saying, you don't like to view it as the property value, here's your money. So what's wrong? How can you learn it from the Mishnah? Obviously, underlying this is a more fundamental question of how do we view a lien? How exactly does it work? So me dummy says Rava, it's not the same at all. Hatam itlu pseida liyatmi. Over there, the other group of Yatomim are going to be ending up losing very clear monies because of your artificial kind of accounting practices. Whereas Acha me itlu pseida, I understand. Does this guy lose anything? Oh, you mean he's losing what he would like? He would like to be able to take the houses. We're not interested in what he likes. We're interested in money. He has a lien for money. Now he had 1,000 zuz that he was yoyiv. That's what he lent. He's collecting 1,000 zuz. In what way is he losing anything? I don't know what you're doing over here. Therefore, we will allow him to do exactly this little trick and get to keep the houses. Says the Gemara, but now this is weird because when this guy who paid up and artificially raised the value of the house to 1,000 and got the guy to accept 1,000, what this guy is actually doing now is going to go to court and he's going to sue the seller. Now, obviously, the seller has no money. Because otherwise, if he had money or he had other property, then the original lender would have been able to collect from the original borrower, who is the seller. Fine. I'm not going to court to collect today. I'm going to court to get a document called a tirfa, which has in it a lien against his future properties and so on, which is what we do all the time. You don't have any money now. One day you're going to have money. We're going to take your money. You sold me a piece of property that you had lien to somebody else, and the guy collected, and property has achrayut. That's what achrayut means, title insurance. It's built into the sale. I'm collecting my title insurance. You don't have money for it. We'll wait till you get money. But now we have a serious issue. How much money? Because technically speaking, all of a sudden this property was worth 1,000 zuz because I artificially raised its value. And it was taken in lieu of 1,000 zuz. So can I get the court to write out 1,000 zuz? Or do we say, no, wait. It's one thing to say that the guy who had been the original lender got his money back with this little trick and therefore he has no rights to complain. But it's a completely different thing to say that an artificial rise in value can be collected by the seller. It's true that an actual rise in value, which property values went up, can be collected. In other words, it's not that when you go back to the seller says, well, what do you mean you're collecting R1 million? I had sold the property to you at $500,000. The buyer says, look, you idiot, I didn't buy a piece of property to hold on to forever at that market value. I bought it because the market went up. Was going up. It was now worth double that. Somebody came along and took it for the full double it, because that's how much money you owed. So go and pay me back now. Did I just save you that money? That anyway you would have had to pay the guy. So give it back to me. He can do that. But in this case, even though technically speaking that's true, but realistically speaking, the 1,000 zuz was not the value of the property. It's only because this guy played this little game that he turned it into the value of the property. So how much do we write the tirfa for? Says the Gemara. The tirfa b'kama katvina. How much do we write the tirfa for in the court? Ravina says, look, the bottom line is it was collected as 1,000. Rav Avira says, no, it was collected before Mishmeya. I mean, it's just that he managed to get back his full 1,000. That wasn't its real value. V'ilchata b'chamesh me'a. Now, halacha is that since you're only collecting for the piece of property that was taken from you, and that piece of property only had a market value, a true market value of 500, you can only collect the tirfa of 500. Ah, you say, but you were willing to put out more money. That's your problem. But it's not the real value of the property. Now, there was another maisa of Ahu Gavra, and it isn't clear what this maisa adds. And we're trying to talk a lot about whether there's any difference at all between this case and the previous case, because it seems to be completely repetitious. Ahu Gavra Davi Maski be Meazuz. It was a man against whom there were as a loan from 100 zuz. And he had two little tiny plots of land, vegetable patches. So Avile Treka Tina Diara, and he sold one for 50 and the other one for 50, and the Baal Chof came and took one of the 50s, and Hoda Razavikatar Velidach, he's about to take the other one away to collect his 100. That guy goes, takes 100 zuz, because of the Gabe, and he says to him, look, you're ready to take 100 zuz for it? Fine, because that's what it's worth to me. If it's not worth that much to you, then give it to me, and here's the 100 zuz. Exactly the same case, right? Now I'm the proud owner of my field. I don't have anybody worrying about it. Now I'll go sue the other guy to give me back my money. So fine, go away. Again, he brought this to court. The other guy wanted the vegetable patch, and he said, look, you know, who are you? I don't know who you are. You can't force me to take your money. I was owed money by the guy who sold you this patch. You go talk to him. I want the patch. So it comes to Rav Yosef. So Sover Rav Yosef Lameimar, Hainu Matiti, isn't that exactly the case of the Mishnah, in which if the Yatomim said, Imam Ru Yatomim, the Yatomim said, etc., that we don't listen to them. To which a buyer responded, what do you mean? It's not similar at all to our Mishnah. In the case of the Mishnah, he's going to be causing a hefsid to the other group of Yatomim. What possible loss is there to him? Mea Yaiv, he made a loan of 100, and Mea Shekel, he's taking back 100. And again, the Gemara is a tirfa v'kama. How much is the tirfa that we're going to use to collect from the seller, the original borrower, who now sold without coverage for when he does end up getting money together? How much is it for? So there are two. Ever machlokas, Ravina Amar b'meya, Ravavir Amar b'chamishin, Ve'elchata b'chamishin. Okay. Now there's another case. Avu Gavra, Davi Maski b'meya zuzi. A guy who had a debt of 100 against him, and he dies. He left, Shava Katina da'ara, he left a little piece of property, which was only worth 50 zuz. So the guy comes and he collects his loan from the heirs, from that piece of property. Now those Yitomim really loved that little vegetable patch, and it was all that they had left from their father. So they got together 50 zuz, okay? And they gave him 50 zuz, and they took it back. So he comes the next day and says, well, I still owe another 50 zuz, so I'll be taking that from you. So on that katarifa, he goes ahead now to collect against the other 50 zuz that he had never collected. So they were outraged. They said, what do you mean? You only had the right to collect once. You collected. So we bought it back from you. We're like anybody else that bought it back. What kind of business is that? You have no legal right of collecting. You utilized your lien. It's over, man. So they took him to court, and he comes in front of Abaya. Abaya said to them, look, gentlemen, there is no clear-cut indication that what you did was actually a payment for the field. Because, you see, it's a mitzvah anyway on Yatomim to pay back debts for their father. Not because there's a lien, without a lien. Because the halacha is that it's kavod to an individual that after he dies, his debts are taken care of. And it's an honor to your father's memory to pay it back. And it's included in the mitzvah of kibud av v'aim as a drabbanan specific chiyuv. Beis din cannot be kofin, they can't force you. So therefore, we never could have forced you to pay. The guy didn't have that option. But you were kind enough to do so. So that's very nice. Now the guy would like to collect the field, which he never did. So he's going to collect the field. So hanikamoi mitzvah avaditu. Basically, the first 50, that was a mitzvah that you did in honor of your father's memory. And now he's coming to collect the field for the remaining 50 that you're saying you don't have the money to pay him. So kitarif bedin katarif. So now he's in fully within his rights to collect a debt with a lien that had never yet been used for collection.
You are talking about after you already collected it. The guy collected it. They went back and paid
right.
it. So he's already used the lien. So you can't say no.
No, they're saying, no, actually, we paid you. Okay, so then, fine. So I'm sticking with my collection.
Right.
All right. But this is only if they didn't say at the time that they paid the money, they didn't say openly, listen, man, we don't want any shtick with your claiming that this is a payment on the loan. We are not paying you for our father's loan. Memory be damned. We want that piece of property. We're buying a piece of property. You understand? So, in that case, if they say, something they didn't say, we are giving this you this money because we want the land and we're paying you, we're buying it from you, just like anybody else in the street. If they said that, then obviously, then it's over. He already did utilize his lien. The money that they're paying, they bought it back from him. How could he possibly go and recollect again? Alright, now there's two possibilities here of how to understand this Gemara. Most Rishonim learn like Rashi's second shot. Rashi's second shot is that there is a piece of property against which this person's mother would be able to collect her ketuvah if she ever got around to collecting her ketuvah. She's basically an old lady who doesn't think about these things. And so he figures, you know what? Let me get some money out of it, at least. So I'll sell it, and I'll tell the buyer, I'll say, look, you know, the truth is that my mother may one day come and collect this field because my father had set it aside and mortgaged it to her for her ketuvah. Personally, I don't think she's ever going to even think about it. That's the truth. But if she does, I mean, she's going to take it away from you. I want that understood. And I'm not interested now in paying you back. And it's got to be understood. I'm selling this to you without any title insurance. You're fully aware of the possibilities. Obviously, I'm only going to take 40 cents to the buck. And if you're willing to buy it on that basis, fine. You're taking your chances. I'm taking a lower price. But I'm not going to give you your money back if there's any to be on court. So that's Rashi's.